Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear this week's lesson in everyday grammar. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Katie Weaver will tell us about a recent study on vehicle traffic around the world.
Vehicle traffic is getting worse in the United States and many cities in the world, a recent study has found. But new policies in some cities have proven effective in reducing the number of vehicles on the road. By cutting automobile travel, many cities are also cutting releases of pollutive waste gases and shortening the time it takes for people to get to work. However, overall, drivers in 2019 spent more time trapped in traffic than in past years. INRIX Incorporated, a private business that studies transportation, released its yearly report on traffic last week. INRIX ranked congestion in more than 900 cities worldwide. In the United States, the report found that on average, drivers lost 99 hours last year because of traffic congestion. That is an increase of 2 hours from 2017. The report also says congestion cost drivers nearly $88 billion in 2019, or an average of $1,377 each. For the second year in a row, Boston, Massachusetts, topped the list as the most congested city in the U.S. The average commuter lost 149 hours a year to traffic. That cost each driver $2,205 for time lost in congestion. Coming up behind Boston on the U.S. list was Chicago, Illinois, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, New York City, New York, and Washington, D.C. Los Angeles, California, historically, has been known for bad traffic, but it ranked sixth in this report. Researchers say usual congestion does not have the same effect there because the area is so large and has a huge road system. Worldwide, Bogota, Colombia, topped the list as the most congested city, with drivers losing 191 hours a year. Right behind was Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, with 190. Mexico City was third, with 158 hours lost a year, followed by Istanbul, Turkey, with 150. Behind them were Sao Paulo, Rome, Paris, London, Boston, and Chicago. Overall, the most congested cities are older cities or those growing quickly, INRIX reports. The company says this shows that very fast urbanization is taking place in Latin America. And, INRIX says, some cities in Europe are not well designed for automobile use. The report found Wichita, Kansas, had the lowest levels of congestion. Drivers there lost less than 2 hours a year in traffic. INRIX collected and studied location data from car makers, mobile apps, and freight drivers. The data did not identify drivers themselves. Trevor Reed, an INRIX researcher, wrote the report. He said congestion fees on drivers in the British and Swedish capitals and in Singapore have reduced car traffic considerably. New York plans to add congestion fees in 2021. It would be the first U.S. city to do so. The fees might lead to fewer cars on roads. Chicago and Los Angeles are studying possible use of such fees. I'm Katie Weaver.
Recently, I was watching an American television news report about the coronavirus. In it, the reporter said, due to coronavirus concerns, Washington Governor Jay Inslee is banning gatherings of more than 250 people at social and religious events in some parts of the state. It got me thinking about how much we use phrases like due to describe a relationship between things. Due to is a preposition, and one of many in English that are formed from two or more words. We call them compound prepositions. The English language has more than 50 compound prepositions, but not all are commonly used. On today's Everyday Grammar program, we will explore a few two-word prepositions that often appear in news coverage, including in stories from our website. They are according to, due to, and rather than. We will begin by briefly discussing what prepositions are and how we use them. A preposition is a word or group of words that shows direction, place or time, or introduces an object. Prepositions are always followed by a noun, proper noun, pronoun, noun phrase, or gerund. For example, in the sentence, "The book is on the table," the preposition "on" is followed by the noun phrase, "the table." Here is our first compound preposition of the day. The preposition according to means as stated or reported by someone who is not the speaker. We often use it to offer official evidence, such as in news stories or research reports. Here is part of a recent story you may have seen on the Learning English website about the wild animals called rhinos. Rhinos are already critically endangered. There are only about 29,000 alive, according to the International Rhino Foundation. Around 5% of the animals are in Kenya. Use of according to here tells us the information comes from the International Rhino Foundation. Here is another example from a story that explores why American newspapers endorse presidential candidates. Before the 2012 elections, for example, 17 large U.S. newspapers chose not to endorse a presidential candidate, according to National Public Radio. Here, the information comes from National Public Radio. Notice that, in both examples, according to appears after the factual information. But it can also appear at the start of sentences. For example, you could say, according to the International Rhino Foundation, there are only about 29,000 alive. Though according to is formal, there are exceptions. Suppose you are on a road trip with family. You are looking at driving directions on your phone. You might say, according to Google Maps, it will take 2 hours and 35 minutes to get to the next town. Though the map information itself is official, in this case, the social situation is informal. Now let's return to the preposition due to. The phrase due to can have a few meanings, but when it acts as a preposition, it means because of something. Due to refers to a reason or cause, such as coronavirus causing bans of large social gatherings in many places. The preposition due to is also somewhat formal. It is common in official announcements or statements and in the news. Here is another example from a story about an environmental concern in China. It uses a statement from a science expert. The ecology of the Yangtze River is close to collapse due to human activity in past decades, Pan said. With due to, the sentence introduces the cause, which is human activity in the past decades. It also talks about a result, which is that the ecology of the Yangtze River is close to collapse. You could also move due to the beginning of the sentence and say it this way. Due to human activity in the past decades, the ecology of the Yangtze River is close to collapse. And finally, we turn to rather than. The preposition rather than means in place of or instead of something or someone. Listen to how it was used in a recent Learning English story about active shooter preparation exercises for American students. Take mental note of the two things that are contrasted. There has been little research on how well the exercises prepare students for an active shooter. In 2007, one study found it better to prepare students for an intruder rather than a shooter. The contrast is between intruders and shooters. In other words, the study showed that preparing students for an intruder is better than preparing them for a shooter. Our final example comes from a story about how the city of Nashville, Tennessee, is now a popular place for many kinds of sound recordings, including films and video games. The city is known for very good studio musicians. They work mostly on recordings rather than live performances. Here, the contrast is between recordings and live performances. Well, that's all for today's program. Look and listen for these prepositions in VOA Learning English stories and programs.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue our series of time capsule programs, each one exploring another facet, decade, or period of America in the 20th century. Science brings an end to World War II and lays the groundwork for a new attention to research, development, and scientific education in the years to come. World War II ended with an action that was never taken before in the history of warfare and has never been taken since. It required the efforts of a team of scientists. Working in secrecy, they designed and built the first atomic bombs. President Harry S. Truman made the decision to use these weapons against Japan in August of 1945.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
America's use of atomic weapons brought years of conflict in Europe and the Pacific to an end. But it also marked the beginning of the nuclear age. And it represented, in a dramatic way, the growing importance of science and technology in modern times. Interest in science goes back to the earliest days of the nation. President Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were famous not only as political leaders, but also as inventors and scientists. President Abraham Lincoln and Congress established the National Academy of Sciences during the Civil War in the 1860s. And in the early 1900s, the nation created scientific offices to study and improve agriculture, public health, even air travel. By the start of World War I in 1914, the federal government was employing scientists in many areas of work. President Woodrow Wilson created the National Research Council to organize the work of scientists and engineers to win the war. However, before World War II, government support for science was generally limited. The government was willing to pay for research only to meet certain clear goals, such as better weapons or military transport systems. World War II greatly changed the traditionally limited relationship between American scientists and the federal government. In the early years of the war, the German forces of Adolf Hitler showed the world the power of their new tanks, guns, and other weapons. President Franklin Roosevelt knew that the United States would need to develop modern weapons of its own if it entered the war. For this reason, Roosevelt established a National Defense Research Committee in 1940 to support and organize research on weapons. The new committee included some of the top scientists in America. Among its members were the presidents of Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Bell Laboratories. The committee did its work so well that Roosevelt later formed an even more powerful Office of Scientific Research and Development. The leader of both groups was Vannevar Bush, no relation to the future presidents. He had long experience as a professor of electrical engineering and as an inventor. Many scientists knew him. Vannevar Bush put together a hard-working team, and in the years that followed, American scientists and engineers developed one invention after another to help the war effort. Scientists developed new devices to help the Navy find German submarines. They improved methods for bombers to find their targets. And they developed more powerful rockets to protect American troops when they landed on foreign beaches. American scientists and doctors also made great progress in improving the methods of wartime medicine. World War II may well have been the first war in history in which a wounded soldier was more likely to survive than to die. But in many ways, the most important scientific development of the period was the atomic bomb. In 1939, Albert Einstein wrote President Roosevelt a letter. The scientist told the president that it might soon be possible to build a powerful weapon, a weapon that would use the power of the atom. And he urged Roosevelt to get American scientists to build the atomic bomb before German scientists could build one. Roosevelt agreed. He created a special team of scientists. Their work became known as the Manhattan Project. Roosevelt made sure that these scientists got all the money and supplies they needed. Roosevelt died before the scientists could complete their work. But in April 1945, the scientists told the new president, Harry Truman, that they were almost ready to test their invention. Just 3 months later, they exploded the world's first atomic bomb in the desert in the southwestern state of New Mexico. Truman had to make a difficult decision. He knew the atomic bomb would cause widespread death and suffering if it was used on a Japanese city. But he was willing to do anything to avoid the need for American troops to invade Japan. In Japan, a new prime minister and government were searching for a way to end the war. But Truman believed that the Japanese were still not ready to surrender, and he felt it was his duty to end the war as soon as possible. On August 6, 1945, the first atomic bomb fell on the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, a second A-bomb fell on the city of Nagasaki.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us.
President Truman.
It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemies.
The Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Japan estimates that between 150,000 and 246,000 people died within 2 to 4 months of the bombings. The bombings left Japan's rulers with no choice. In less than 1 week, they surrendered.
I received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan. In the reply, there is no qualification. Arrangements are now being made for the formal signing of the surrender terms at the earliest possible moment. General Douglas MacArthur has been appointed the Supreme Allied Commander to receive the Japanese surrender.
In this newsreel, we hear General MacArthur accepting the surrender of the Japanese Empire.
The battleship Missouri, 53,000-ton flagship of Admiral Halsey's Third Fleet, becomes the scene of an unforgettable ceremony marking the complete and formal surrender of Japan. General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Allied Commander for the occupation of Japan, boards the Missouri. Fleet Admiral Nimitz, Pacific Fleet Commander, and Admiral Halsey welcome MacArthur and his Chief of Staff, General Sutherland, aboard. It is Sunday, September 2nd, 1945.
We are gathered here, representatives of the major warring powers, to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored. The issues involving divergent ideals and ideologies have been determined on the battlefields of the world, and hence are not for our discussion or debate. The terms and conditions upon which surrender of the Japanese Imperial Forces is here to be given and accepted are contained in the instrument of surrender now before you. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated.
American scientists and engineers proved that a war could be won with research as well as bullets. And all Americans learned how much could be gained when government agencies, scientists, and universities worked together for common goals. Roosevelt had understood this long before the war ended. He asked Vannevar Bush to study how the federal government could work with scientists and universities in peacetime. Bush offered a number of ideas to President Truman at the end of the war. He told the president that science was important to America's progress and safety. He called on the federal government to support scientific study and education. Professor Bush said that the nation's universities should be greatly strengthened. He called for the creation of a new government agency to provide money for science projects. Truman and Congress agreed with Vannevar Bush, and in the next few years, American research efforts expanded. In 1946, the Office of Naval Research was created to support basic science study in universities. In the same year, the government created the Atomic Energy Commission. And in 1950, it created the National Science Foundation to provide support to thousands of the nation's best scientists. In the years that followed, American science would grow beyond the wildest dreams of Vannevar Bush and other scientists of his time. Universities would add thousands of new students, along with new laboratories and research centers. By the middle of the 1960s, the federal government would spend more than $13 billion a year for research and development. And 500 new centers of higher learning would be created. All this investment would help make the United States the world leader in such fields as computer science, genetics, and space travel.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.